I'm Dr. John Litt. I'm a public health physician and academic GP, and we're here today to talk about vaccination in older people.
It gives me great pleasure to introduce Professor Paul Van Binder, who's going to talk about vaccination in older persons. Paul, can you tell us a bit about your background, about what you do and why you're interested in vaccines in older people particularly?
So I'm a public health physician, and most of my focus is on population health activity. For the last 30 years, I've worked in largely vaccinology with an interest in improving protection for older people in particular, people in aged care institutions, but people right across the life course who could do with the benefit of vaccines.
Okay, so let's get rolling. So why is vaccination important in older people?
Older people actually suffer disproportionately from most infectious diseases, including vaccine-preventable diseases. We know that they get 90% of the hospitalizations from flu, that they're more likely to be hospitalized with whooping cough than young children even, that they get lots of pneumococcal disease, and that they get really, really nasty responses to shingles disease. So all of these are vaccine preventable. They have very low coverage rates at the moment compared to what happens with our children. We think we need to overcome the ageist vaccine policy and actually get more older people vaccinated. Our immune system starts to wane in adolescence. The role of the thymus, which regresses after adolescence, is critically important in developing all of those precursor T cells that turn into our memory T cells and our killer T cells. And our functional T cell capacity continues to decline as we age. And it's made worse by being chronically infected with diseases like CMV, which soak up a lot of our immune response. But throughout this, what we do know is that we have less capacity to deal with infection, and we have less capacity to respond to vaccines as we age. And so for that reason, we know that some of our vaccines don't work as well in older people as they do in younger people. However, we also know that they still remain the best possible response that we can give them to try and protect them against these particularly nasty diseases. And so they may be 50% or 60% effective instead of 100%, but not vaccinating them produces no protection whatsoever. We have to use what's available to us and make sure that even if they don't work quite as well, that we're getting older people vaccinated.
So, Paul, that's really good information. And we know that the vaccines are going to be the only alternative, because actually all those other lifestyle stuff there, like activity, physical activity, eating well, not smoking, drinking in moderation, don't have an effect on the immune system. And this immune senescence, this decay in the immune system, really needs a vaccine to counter it. And in some cases, you know, things like the zoster vaccine, we need a lot more antigen to get the benefit. So we actually need vaccines to boost people's immunity.
One of the tragedies of infectious diseases in older people is that if they come out the other side, if they don't pass away from their flu or whatever they're getting, then their functional capacity decreases enormously. And so these are people who are healthy, living at home, are hospitalised with influenza, and then we look for an assisted care place. One of the things that a healthy lifestyle, doing some exercise, doing some limited light weights, eating good foods, will do, will it actually maintain you at a higher level of functional capacity beforehand. And so that means that when you do get unwell and you suffer the consequences of an infectious disease, hopefully at the end of it, that you are in a better place than you would have been if you were particularly frail beforehand, because you weren't doing all of the healthy things beforehand. So I don't want to denigrate the benefit of living a healthy lifestyle, and it certainly can help with the end point. But the only thing that's going to make a huge difference is being vaccinated.
Yeah, I'm saying it's important in a lot of vascular disease and diabetes. I'm just saying in terms of boosting immune systems, it's not. It's the vaccine that people actually need in that situation. But the really kind of important point you're making is that the functional decline is slow, is closely correlated with decline in quality of life. And that's what people want. They want a good quality of life and be able to be independent. And so by having the vaccine, by having the illness and ending up in hospital, you're losing functional capacity, and that's going to have a big impact on quality of life.
Yeah.
What do you think is a desirable level of coverage for people over the age of 65?
I think vaccines through the life course means that we have the same targets for our older persons as we do for younger persons. And we really don't get anywhere near approaching that, except in some closed settings, like some residential care facilities, we'll get 90-95% coverage for our older people in care for influenza. But we're probably lucky to get half of our older people vaccinated with pneumococcal vaccine. We've just started a program 2 or 3 years ago with Zostavax in the older groups, and we don't have good data yet, but we suspect that less than half of them have been vaccinated. And
this is people in the target age group or across 70 to 79? Yep.
And we also know that pertussis in the elderly has a higher incidence rate than in younger groups, that there's actually more older people who die of whooping cough than there is young babies, and that we have significant hospitalizations for things like cracked ribs after chronic cough and so on. So, you know, we need to address the fact that in that group, in older persons over 65, we don't even have a 10% effective coverage for pertussis. And we're really focused on saying, if you have grandchildren, get vaccinated to protect your grandchild, whereas really we should be saying this is a nasty disease in old people. All of you get vaccinated to protect yourselves.
So, Paul, let's get specific. There's a couple of things I want to ask you about influenza. We've got two vaccines, two enhanced vaccines we had in 2018. It's a different situation in 2019. Which vaccine should GPs be offering? Should they be offering the increased antigen dose, which is the Fluzone, or should they be offering the adjuvanted flu vaccine, Fluad?
And so last year, GPs had a choice of both vaccines, and they were both funded under the National Immunisation Program. This year, both vaccines will probably be available in Australia, but only Fluad is being offered under the national free scheme. So we have no data that suggests one or the other is better. And there certainly can't be a case made that says people who are entitled to a free adjuvanted vaccine should instead go and pay whatever the cost is, $30, $40, $50 for a high dose. They won't get additional benefit by going to the other one. And so we believe that GPs should offer the adjuvanted vaccine that's free to all elderly people.
The Fluad, the one that's provided free to them, it's going to be in their fridge.
Yep.
And it's available.
Part of that.
Yep. Okay, so
maybe people who say, last year I had the high dose, why can't I have it this year? And the answer is that if they really want to pay for it, they can. But we don't think that there's any benefit in having that instead of the Fluad that's funded and will be available for all GPs.
So we're seeing that the two vaccines are largely equivalent. Okay, so let's keep going. So is the best time to give it? I mean, there's some talk that it doesn't last the flu season. We've had flu in December. What's the best timing for people over 60?
And this is very challenging for general practitioners, because I do know that as soon as March arrives, we start seeing advertisements from chemists in particular saying, hurry up and get your flu shot and, you know, make an appointment and come and see us. And they're doing that when it's 35 degrees outside and worrying people into coming and getting it early. We know that particularly in a H3N2 year, this vaccine in older people probably lasts 4 months or so, and we don't want to be giving it to people in March if flu is going to turn up in September, October. We hoped that giving the enhanced vaccines last year might have produced longer protection, that it didn't matter quite as much. But we've seen in older people in December, January, and even as early as November, big outbreaks of influenza, particularly in Southeast Queensland, New South Wales, and even across in Perth. We think we need to delay influenza vaccine for older persons until mid-May or a time like that. We don't believe it places them at risk of getting influenza. We think there's much more chance that they'll still have good protection when influenza actually arrives.
Is there an alternative if they're there to see you to give them one and then give them a second dose? So is there a value in having two doses of the...
We don't believe at this point of time that there is value in giving two doses. There are only two studies that we're aware of, one in Hong Kong when they gave southern and then northern hemisphere, and the second reaction wasn't quite as good. There was a separate Asian study giving two doses of the same vaccine that actually did produce a benefit, but we do not have data that says this is a good idea. Certainly, it's not funded for older people to have two doses of vaccine. Where I think there is some benefit in GPs looking specifically at the person they're talking to is if the person had a vaccine in April and they're turning up in October because all of a sudden there is a lot of influenza around and they've got chronic obstructive airways disease and they got pneumonia once and ended up, you know, really severely ill in hospital, then I think it's reasonable for the GP to consider whether or not he would give a second dose. But certainly there is no recommendation that says all people over the age of 65 should get two doses of vaccine.
So the GP, he or she, should give a second dose in that situation?
In that situation, they could consider it.
Now, healthcare workers, we kind of controversially know that GPs probably get the flu vaccine about 70% of the time and specialists less. Should all healthcare workers get the flu vaccine?
I think it's morally and ethically unacceptable for healthcare workers, particularly those who are involved in vaccination, who are picking up a six-week baby and getting really close to them, people working in aged care with very frail elderly people, to not protect themselves and protect these people that they're looking at. And I've heard healthcare workers say to me, I have a choice, I have a right, I have the rest of it. You have a right to do no harm. And if you're not protected, if you're not getting influenza vaccine and the other vaccines, and you're a healthcare worker, then you're in breach of your professional responsibilities.
So it's a duty of care. There's also evidence that I'm aware of is that people often who have an influenza-like illness don't think they've got the flu. And some of the serology studies have actually shown that 15 to 20% of them do. So they're thinking they're not got influenza, they're seeing patients, and they're now exposing vulnerable people to that. So it's another reason you can't always know that you've got influenza, and that people often, healthcare workers particularly, soldier on.
And we know that for the first 24 hours before you're symptomatic, you're already infectious and spreading virus. So you can't say, I stay home when I'm sick. Many of them don't, and many of them infect people before they realise they're sick.
So another reason for everyone to get it. Okay. What about reception and other staff who might have contact with patients in practice?
And we know that where we're saying healthcare workers, this means anybody who's in contact with people who are vulnerable if they become infected. So your receptionist is more likely to get the flu themselves because people who are sick come in all of the time. They need to be protected so they're not on sharing the influenza with others. People who are cleaners at the hospital need to have influenza vaccine. Everybody who is part of the healthcare caring system, apart from those that are in the basement looking at medical records, need to make sure that they're protecting themselves and protecting the vulnerable people they're looking after.
It's a knock health and safety issue too, isn't it? You can't have half your staff off if you've got a lot of flu doing the rounds, and so you actually want, it's in your interest to have everybody covered. So let's move on to pneumococcal vaccine in older people there. So while the recommendation is currently being reviewed by the PBAC and the TAGI, the kind of existing recommendation is to give them the 23-valent polysaccharide vaccine at 65. So how effective is this vaccine against invasive disease and community-acquired pneumonia?
This vaccine is very effective against invasive disease. It's as effective as the conjugated vaccines against invasive disease, and we think it's probably around 70% effective against those types that are actually included in the vaccine itself.
And against community-acquired pneumonia?
This is a very controversial area, and we've had dozens of studies that have all varied in their design and the way they come out. And we've really had people saying it's 50% effective, and we've people saying it's totally ineffective. We think it's probably somewhere in the middle, around 25 to 35% effective against community-acquired pneumonia. That's caused by vaccine type. So this, again, is the best we have available at the moment. We do really badly in getting coverage, so we're hoping that general practitioners will visit this with all of their older patients this year.
Okay. And how long will that protection last if they get a dose of the polysaccharide pneumococcal vaccine?
The polysaccharide vaccine lasts for at least 2 years. There are some data that may stretch out to around 5 years. We used to say that everybody should get a booster after 5 years, But we had some challenges, particularly with what we call hyper-responsiveness, the vaccine not working as well the second time. And now we've got special groups that we do say should have booster doses. But if somebody's 65, living in the community, independent and well, they just need to have the single pneumococcal vaccine at 65 years of age.
So there, you're actually alluding to other groups. So there are people at higher risk and just, well, increased risk there. Should they be offered extra doses? And how does the GP work out the complexity of that?
And this is an incredibly complex area. And the National Centre for Immunisation Research and Surveillance and the Australian Immunisation Handbook has very detailed information on who should be getting extra doses. It's based on the degree of risk that you have to developing invasive pneumococcal disease, not pneumonia. And certain groups, what they call category A, need to have three doses of vaccine, the two boosters at 5-year time periods. Other groups in category B need to have two doses of vaccine, so one booster after 5 years. Many of them have had one before 65. There are other groups like Indigenous groups that have a different schedule. People who've had a stem cell transplant get three doses of conjugated vaccine first. So this is not look over your thumb if they've had asthma, do this. We really recommend that people who've got risk factors, people who do have a condition in one of these, that the GP goes back to the lists that are available and follows those lists rather than trying to remember for these 15 conditions I do this and then for those 12 I do something different. So boosters are given to people at high risk of invasive disease, but please check the available information before deciding what to do.
So Paul, the good news for GPs is there's actually a online computer tool called Pneumosmart that can make that process of which pneumococcal vaccine and the interval available. Can you just very briefly talk about that?
This is a tool that was developed by the Immunisation Coalition. It's updated on an annual basis. If you put Pneumosmart into Google or pneumosmart.org, you'll find this tool, and you can put the specifics of your patient into the tool and it'll tell you what to do from the point of view of giving those people vaccines.
So if they've had a CSF leak or they're a smoker or whatever, it'll
modify the process for you.
Saving you trying to look it up in the handbook. Okay, so there's just one final question in the pneumococcal section, and that's about the conjugate vaccine. So to date, you've been talking about the polysaccharide, which is the 23-valent. There is a conjugate vaccine, a 13-valent Prevnar, which is certainly recommended in children. At the moment, it hasn't been put on the schedule, but it seems to have a higher effectiveness against community-acquired pneumonia. And you've mentioned already it's probably similar or slightly better than the polysaccharide vaccine against invasive disease. Simple question, should we be using the conjugate vaccine?
Certainly this is, again, a very controversial area, the use of conjugated vaccines in the elderly. And if we look around the world, Germany decided not to use it, England decided not to use it, Canada decided not to use it. Some Asian countries are using it, some Asian countries are using both. In the US, they're using both, and we're waiting on their data to come out. What I can say is that there is no funding, so that if you want to give an older person a conjugated vaccine, then you need to have the person pay for it at this point of time. That may change in Australia. The other thing is it's very important if you're giving both vaccines, conjugated and the free pneumococcal vaccine, the polysaccharide, that you do them in a specific order and have specific time gaps. We know that giving the one that we provide at the moment, Pneumo 23, to older persons, following up too closely with a conjugated vaccine produces a decreased response to that vaccine. So if you're going to give both, and there are certainly groups in Australia like the Society of Geriatricians who've got a formal policy to recommend that both are given, then you need to first give the conjugated vaccine, the Prevnar 13, and then afterwards give the Pneumo 23. If they've already had a Pneumo 23, please wait at least 12 months before giving the conjugated vaccine.
Okay, so we'll move on to zoster. So is shingles a big issue? Is it important for older people?
Two of my family have had shingles, my father before he passed and my sister who had ophthalmic shingles, and it's a dire, dire, nasty disease. I was disappointed to see a survey a few years ago saying that 4% of the elderly were worried about shingles. We know that by the time you get to 85 years of age, you've got a 1 in 2 chance of developing shingles. And a third of those at that age will go on to get what we call post-herpetic neuralgia. They have chronic, unremitting pain for months, and it's very difficult to find adequate treatment for it. So this is a disease that we need to try and stop. And it's on the increase, and it's not only on the increase because we're living longer and we're older, but even age-specific rates are going up. So, you know, they say about 120,000 to 150,000 Australians will get shingles each year. Those numbers are going up, and it's a terrible disease.
Right. So it's caused a lot of disability, both acutely, and what we're hearing, the commonest complication, post-herpetic neuralgia, is also really problematic and lasts for a very long period of time. So do we have a vaccine against it, and is the vaccine safe? So there are two questions there.
We do have a vaccine against it. We've had a vaccine that we've been using for over 2 years now. And one of the challenges of this vaccine from a safety perspective is this is a live vaccine. It's essentially the same as the chickenpox vaccine we give children, but it's 14 times the dose. And the reason it's 14 times the dose is that we're trying to overcome antibodies present in the older people and stimulate their T cells, their cell-mediated immunity, to try and provide protection against shingles. So it's a vaccine that we know works. The younger you are, the better you are because of the immune senescence that we talked about earlier. But
you mean a better response. You get a higher antibody level.
A better response to this. And we get greater protection levels if we give it to people earlier. At the moment, the vaccine is funded only for people between the ages of 70 and 79 in Australia. They're entitled to a dose. We don't boost at the moment. But it's licensed in Australia from 50 years upwards. And it's actually recommended, although not funded, for people between 60 and 69 years in Australia as well. So we have a vaccine. There's only one available in Australia. Its effectiveness decreases as you age. It's probably 50% effective for people in the younger, older group, if that makes sense. And then it decreases once you get to 70s and 80. One of the great things about this vaccine is its protection against the really, really nasty chronic pain is around 2/3. And that stays the same as you get older. So even if it doesn't stop you getting shingles when you get older, it stops you getting the nasty complication. But it is a live vaccine. It's not safe to give to a whole range of people who are living with immune suppressive drugs for their arthritis and various other conditions. So it's very important that all GPs have a contraindication list that they check before they give this vaccine and make sure that they're not giving it to somebody who's going to have a particularly nasty reaction.
So we've got a vaccine. It is really effective against post-herpetic neuralgia. As you get older, it may not be quite as effective against acute zoster, and you've talked about the age groups for that. So what about, and you've also said, I mean, it's available from the age of 50. I had my zoster vaccine at 60 because we know that the incidence of zoster rises. What do you say to people under 70 or over 80? Because it's licensed in those groups, but it's not part of the program.
And certainly, I think this is a very important point. And I think there are a lot of vaccines that we need to be considering in older persons that may not be funded. And the absence of funding does not actually say we shouldn't be discussing this with our older people when they come in. Everybody from the age of 60 to 69 is actually recommended to have it by our technical advisory group. And I believe that there should be a mechanism for all GPs to discuss this vaccine with their 60 to 69-year-olds. And it's critical to discuss it with those groups and even some younger groups if there's some chance that they may develop a contraindication moving forward. If you have somebody that's 65 and you're about to start them on medication that's going to be a contraindication to them having a zoster vaccine later, give them their zoster vaccine, offer it to them at that point of time rather than waiting till they're 70 saying, hey, it's free for you now, but we can't give it to you because you're on this medication. So please discuss the fact this vaccine works even better between 60 and 69 and try and see whether or not you can encourage them to get themselves protected. It works very well. People under the age of 60 are a little bit more controversial. It's licensed. It's not recommended. And one of the reasons is the duration of effectiveness. And so we know that at this stage, it looks like it works well for 5 years. It might stretch out to 8 or 10, but it's certainly starting to decline at that point. If you're giving it to people in their 50s, then we're really not sure about boosting doses and when they actually have more likelihood of developing disease later on, whether it still works. So I think the message is talk to your patients, consider them individually, make sure you think about this with everybody over the age of 50. I gave the zoster vaccine to my wife when she was 56 for Valentine's Day. And I think that they are the sorts of things that you can do in that sort of setting. What better present can you give your wife than protection for years against a really particularly nasty disease? And so talk to your patients. There are certainly absolute benefit from 60 to 69. Consider it if you're starting some medication or if something else happening in the health of that particular person. I think that the benefit over the age of 80 is less clear because it's a vaccine that probably is effective 15 to 20% once you get to that age. But do remember that it's still very protective against post-herpetic neuralgia. And if this is something that's within their capacity to fund, then certainly it's worth giving it to the people over the age of 80 as well.
And there's some evidence from the Kaiser Permanente data where they actually had nearly 5,000 people who over 80 who'd had the vaccine. And the vaccine protection against acute zoster was not dissimilar to that in 70 to 79, but it's a good point. The other thing I think just worth emphasising is there is a checklist. It's readily available online, and we're both suggesting that every GP should actually get the patient to go through that checklist. We had a case of a patient with chronic lymphatic leukaemia who shouldn't have had the vaccine and died, and there's been one in the UK. So the NSEERs have a very good frequently asked question, sheet, and on that sheet they've actually got the various immunocompromised states where you should be avoiding the vaccine. Or as you were saying, if someone's about to embark on stem cell transplant or some medication, that there's a window often beforehand or at least a time interval afterwards when they can get it. So they can consult that because that time interval will vary according to the conditions. So let's move on to the next one. So if they've actually had a bout of shingles before they get the vaccine, how long do they need to wait before they should consider getting Zostavax?
I think that's very important because I've seen people, including my own family, who've been given a Zoster vaccine when they were still symptomatic and far too early for it to make much difference. One of the things about developing Zoster is that you will actually do what the vaccine does in that you will stimulate your own immune system because you've got an infection at that particular period of time. You've got a recrudescence, it's damaging your nerves, it's circulating, and so we know that your T cells will get a boost. So it's a waste of the cost of a vaccine to say 2 months later, go and have the vaccine. You've already had the boosting equivalent to the vaccine by the disease. We don't know at this point in time how much that boosting is and how long that lasts. There are some inconclusive data that it may even be out to 3 years that you're still protected from that. And what we're saying at the moment is certainly don't give the vaccine within the first 12 months after disease. If they've had disease, think about it after that. But it may be beneficial, depending on their age and other factors, to wait even as long as 3 years before you give vaccine after disease itself.
Okay, now there's a new glycoprotein subunit vaccine paired to a kind of a stronger adjuvant, a kind of recombinant shingles or herpes zoster vaccine. It's working its way through the TGA at the moment. I think it's got initial registration, and we're going to have to wait to hear about the National Immunisation Program. But how effective is this glycoprotein subunit vaccine against zoster and post-herpetic neuralgia?
One of the great changes in vaccination over the last decade or so for older persons is the arrival of adjuvanted vaccines that actually stimulate the immune system and turn on some of these T cells that are really not that functional anymore. We've seen it in influenza vaccines. We're trying to develop it in pertussis. This adjuvanted vaccine that's been available now in North America, Canada, and in Germany is much better from an effectiveness point of view in protection against shingles itself. And we're talking about almost a doubling of protection. And what we saw was as soon as it was licensed and available in the United States, it totally dominates the market there. It's way over 90% of older people in the United States are being given this vaccine by their doctors because the data says this is going to work better for them. And it's not a live vaccine. So you can put away your list of all the different medications and the other things that are there because this is a safe vaccine to give. There are certainly some data that says maybe there's some increased local reactions and systemic reactions initially. And it's a two-dose regime, which is also a challenge compared to a one-dose regime. But this is a substantial improvement in protecting our older people. There are shortages around the world. They're not talking about bringing it here yet. They're still discussing with our money people in Canberra whether they're going to fund this vaccine instead of the other one. But adjuvanted vaccines are usually an improvement over unadjuvanted vaccines, particularly in the elderly with immune senescence. So I'm hopeful that it won't be too long before we actually start to see that available in Australia.
So you're particularly that group who we've been not able to vaccinate, people who are immunocompromised, that's going to be an option for that group. And the local side effects is just worth stating that the rate of that is around 80%. And so while in the original trial they got very good follow-up with the second dose, that's going to have to be monitored very carefully. If a person has a reaction to the first one, they're going to need to be persuaded that the protection comes from having two doses. We don't know whether one dose is going to protect them, and all the evidence from the trials comes from the fact they've had two doses for that. So you've kind of answered my other question about when it's going to be available, not in a hurry. So in the interim, should people wait?
No. I think this is really important that people don't wait. We're hoping that this will be available soon, but we haven't crossed the bridge of government funding. It's unlikely that it would be brought here if it was unfunded. This would be a quite expensive vaccine in two doses for older people. And they are struggling to cope with the demand in the three countries that they've already got it for. There's the rest of Europe, there's the upper income countries in Asia. So I'm expecting that it'll be some years before we have access to that here. They have built a second production plant, so they're increasing their capacity to deliver vaccine. But I would be really disappointed if any of my patients developed shingles and post-herpetic neuralgia in the next few years because I said to them, why don't you wait until the better stuff comes? And so the message is, please protect yourself. Please make sure that you don't get this really nasty disease. And in due course, we'll have something that's more effective and less dangerous in the immune suppressed. And we'll move to that at the time.
We're going to talk very briefly about pertussis, and I think you've already made a comment about how important it is. Do you want to just revisit that and talk about the role of pertussis vaccine in older people?
Yeah. We've certainly had problems with pertussis vaccine in that we had a really, really effective vaccine 15, 20 years ago, a whole cell vaccine.
Many more antigens.
And it was so reactogenic that many people, children and other people, stopped getting the vaccine, didn't finish courses. There was a lot of resistance. We changed that to an acellular vaccine about 15 years ago in Australia. And over the course of time, what we found was it did not produce longer protection. So we've seen outbreaks, 50,000 people in California, and right across the world, and particularly in Australia as well. So we have a vaccine that works but doesn't last very long. And we are boosting our children. We're giving it to all our pregnant women every pregnancy to make sure that they're not infected when the newborn comes out that we can't protect. And we've really had the wrong focus on pertussis in older persons. And so lots of us have got signs up saying, not vaccinated, no kisses. You know, the little child that looks at you and says, it's too dangerous for you to be near your grandchild. And we've been marketing to older people that really, if you've got a small baby that you're going to have some contact with, then protect yourself, protect the baby. But the message has largely been protect the baby. The data that we've started seeing in recent times suggests that the incidence of pertussis in older people is worse than in young children. And young children are all being vaccinated and protected, and older people aren't protected and they're getting the disease. One of the tragedies of whooping cough is even getting the disease doesn't give you lifelong protection. It probably lasts 10 or 20 years and then you're still vulnerable to getting the disease. Older people are hospitalised. They crack ribs. They get complications and they die. And they don't die in dozens and dozens every year like with flu, but they actually die in greater numbers than young children who we really try hard to protect. And so this is the same message, vaccines for life across the life course. We need to convince older people that, A, they are at risk of getting complications, having a cough that lasts for months and frustrates them, even passing away from this disease, that they're not protected unless they've had a recent whooping cough vaccine. There is a recommendation, although it's unfunded in Australia, that at 65 we should check everybody's pertussis status. If they haven't had a booster vaccine in the last 10 years, then give it to them at that stage when you're giving them their pneumococcal vaccine and talking to them about flu and shingles vaccine. So it is the other part of the big four. Don't trivialise pertussis in the elderly and don't feel that it's only if they've got a grandchild that they need to be doing something. We've got to start boosting their protection for them, not for the young babies.
And the other advantage of getting a booster for pertussis is you actually top up your tetanus status, and we know a lot of older people are quite vulnerable. It's reassuring that tetanus is relatively rare, but it largely occurs in people who haven't had a full primary course or whose immune system's waning. So by getting a pertussis booster, they're actually going to get their tetanus and top that up as well. So we're on the home stretch, Paul, and one of the home stretch, literally, if you think about implementation, it's interesting that we put a lot of focus on better vaccines and better science and vaccine efficacy. But I think about a relay race, and it's interesting that the best swimmer in the relay race or the best runner is often the person who runs the final leg. And in healthcare, we don't think about the impact of kind of getting health outcomes. We think we've done our job when we're given the good product. But as you've already alluded to in a number of times, if we don't get high levels of coverage, we don't get the benefit to the patient and to the community. And so that issue, our implementation, is often second cousin to focusing on other things there. So what do we know about implementation that can get high levels of coverage? You said pertussis earlier was around 10%. You've said we've got a pneumococcal coverage around 50%, flu vaccine around 70%. We don't have any official data on Zostavax as yet, but no, we're certainly not up to 80 or 90% or so. What do we do? Now, what are the things that really make a difference for getting high levels of coverage?
I think the challenge is at both levels. That we have a challenge at the patient level and we have a challenge at the physician level. And so I've always believed that the risk-benefit equation is critical for physicians to understand and to be able to clearly articulate to patients. I have a lot of people of all the years, out of the 25% who don't get a flu vaccine, who say to me, I had a vaccine 20 years ago, I was the sickest I've ever been, I'm not letting it give me the flu again, even though I can't give you the flu. People who say, I had the flu 20 times last year, the vaccine didn't work, and they had some other winter virus. And you know, an understanding that the vaccine benefit is X, And in older people, these are the complications of zoster, influenza, pneumonia, and so on, are really important. And the other side of that is we know that general practitioners, that the primary carer is the one who is most likely to encourage older people to actually get vaccinated if they haven't been vaccinated. But we look at our numbers and we see that some of our primary care physicians don't access the vaccine themselves, and they're clearly not going to be having a discussion with older people saying, well, I don't do it, but you should. And some of them don't use the available electronic systems that are available to take away their need to think of what's happening. General practice is a tough gig nowadays. There are a lot of pressures on time. There are a lot of pressures on the complexities of all the things that people have to remember, whether it's asthma plans, the diabetes protocols, and everything else that's going on. Somebody comes to you and they've got a complex issue. It's very easy not to remember that you should be talking to them about other things that are going on. So I believe the more you can use desktop software, the more you can use recall systems, the more you can actually look at programming into something that says, somebody's coming for their 75-year-old check. One of the things I should do is talk to them about vaccination. Somebody's coming in for some other thing. Try and actually build in a system that makes it routine for you as the person they trust to be saying, we need to do better. You haven't been vaccinated. I'm worried that you're going to get one of these really nasty diseases and you're not protected. So I think messaging with GPs, helping them find systems to improve things, is one of the critical things to improving our coverage in these groups.
Okay. I'd largely agree with that. I think I'd summarise it that there are three main areas and they largely overlap with what you suggested. So it's the philosophy about vaccines, and you've really said that very strongly, is that we need to prioritise that to say this is a way of staying healthy. And so, you know, if you're going to do that, there are a whole lot of things you need to do. You need to be more proactive than reactive. The second comment, and there's good data from Australia in terms of the impact of the provider. In the national flu study that I did 20 years ago, we surveyed 4,500 patients in 50 practices, or 50 to 100 practices. And we found when we looked at all the factors, the GP recommendation was the single most important factor for both flu and pneumo. And in round figures, a recommendation from the GP, and you can also say the practice nurse, would increase the likelihood of that person getting the vaccine 8 to 10-fold. 10 years later, when I did the Australian Zoster study and we interviewed 1,300 people, the odds were pretty similar. And so they have a very potent impact. It was a double-edged sword, and you've kind of mentioned it. When you don't mention it, the patient thinks, Mrs. Jones, you know, she says, I don't think I need the vaccine because the doctor hasn't recommended it. If they thought it was important for me, they would have suggested it. And so we know that not discussing it actually reduces the chance of them getting the vaccine. So the recommendation's important. And then the other thing to know about recommendations is it often counters some of those concerns they have about adverse effects. So if they're worried about a sore arm or they're worried about the effectiveness, if you're saying, I recommend it to you because I think it's really worthwhile, that'll counter that. In the study, we found, though, that there are, the third area is some important patient attitudes. And some of the ones that actually didn't respond as much to what the GP was suggesting was, I don't need as I really get sick. And I think one of those factors is addressing the concerns of the patient and saying, age is your biggest risk factor. There are other subgroups. Your best way of staying healthy is to get these vaccines to maintain your function. And you've talked a lot about that. So that you need to kind of address what they're concerned about. So a proactive approach, looking at the practice systems, routinely offering it, and then countering a number of the concerns.
Standing orders enable us to provide vaccines via our clinic staff without the need for the physician to see them, the primary carer, and they really work very effectively in a lot of settings. They're great in places like aged care, but they're also good in general practice as well, where you can actually have something that says people who come in this age group get influenza vaccine, and particularly for those vaccines that we know are safe as safe can be. I'm not suggesting a standing order for everybody who walks in for live vaccines, but certainly for the other vaccines, I think that they are a real boon in trying to get our coverage up. The challenge for some general practitioners is that it doesn't fit the business model of some GPs. There's a process where we can't get a Medicare number and bill if somebody sees the practice nurse and gets standing order vaccines and isn't seen at all by the general practitioner. So there's certainly not a total solution, but I think that they have real benefit in a number of settings.
So we've covered a lot of ground in the talk today. Is there anything else that you want to kind of summarise that we haven't sort of covered?
I think my summary is that in Australia, our vaccine policy is incredibly ageist. You know, we do an enormous amount to try and boost our paediatric coverage. You know, we've got no jab, no pay, no jab, no play. We're getting our coverage from 94.2% to 95.1% with all of these enormous changes and societal impacts to try and get those last little bits. We accept very low rates for a whole series of vaccines in older people, and there's no hue and cry about the fact that we're not managing to achieve much better coverage. And they're suffering significant disease and they're suffering significant residual functional disability. Their life changes forever if they get one of these diseases that we can protect. So the message is vaccines are important across the life course. Vaccines are particularly important for people with reduced immune capacity, with poorer responses to disease, and we need to change the way we think about these in older people so that we're actually getting the big four vaccines at a decent coverage rate into all of our older people.
Thanks, Paul. That's a really nice note to end on, and thanks very much for covering the depth of the topic. It's been very illuminating.
Thank you.